Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
I'm Erica White, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. And today I actually have a guest in the studio, which hardly ever happens for me anymore. Almost all my guests are on the phone. But I will be talking today with Sam Fromarts. Sam is the editor-in-chief of the Food and Environmental Reporting Network, one of my favorite media sources for all things about the food industry and the environment. And he's here to talk about an event that they have going on tonight at, I think it's called the Green Building, is that right? That's Carroll Gardens. And this is, I think, may or may not be sold out. It's worth going on the website to check if you can make it. It's definitely worth your while. It is an event that sounds absolutely amazing. It's called Fern Talks and Eats. It's going to serve up a lot of Fern's written reporting as a dynamic and interactive storytelling experience paired with delicious food by some of New York City's top chefs, including Peter Endres of Runner and Stone, Richard Kuo of Pearl and Ash, Jason Weiner of Almond, and the restaurants Tertulia and Franny's. And in addition, some of Fern's writers, many of whom have been on this show, will be joining. Lisa Hamilton, who I don't know, but Maren McKenna, who's been a regular guest for me, talking about antibiotics in the food chain. Tracy McMillan, who did an amazing James Beard Award-winning story about migrant labor about a year or so ago. Did that turn into a book, Sam?
She had a book already, but the story that she did subsequent to the book was for us. So that's right. The one. It was an award-winning story.
Yeah, it was remarkable, extraordinary. Yeah. And Michelle Nyehouse, who was on my show a few weeks ago, actually, to talk about paddlefish and sturgeon roe and sort of the general state of caviar in the United States. And then, Sam, you will be having a discussion with the one and only Dan Barber.
That's right.
And what are you guys going to be talking about?
Well, we both have books out. Mine came out about a month ago, called In Search of the Perfect Loaf and my obsessions as a bread maker, yes. Amateur bread maker for almost 20 years. And Dan's, a book as well came out in
The Third Plate.
The Third Plate came out in June.
Yeah.
And he talks extensively about grains. So we're going to.
Right.
We're going to kind of unwind grains and breads as well as other subjects.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, grains and breads, we think of bread as being basically wheat or rye. Nobody, I think, really at this point, most bakeries do not really employ a lot of other grains unless they're very specific artisanal type bakeries. So you guys are going to get into some series. What are the other grains that were commonly used for bread back in the day when people made bread a lot?
Well, I think, I make the point in the book that wheat was not the default, grain that to make bread out of. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was always, diverse grains, barley, rye, buckwheat, and these were planted in polycultures, and whatever survived is what you made bread out for the next bread for the next year. And so a lot of the varieties of loaves that you see mostly in Europe now sort of come out of that tradition that really represents a diverse farm, and I think that's something Dan really gets into in the Third Plate.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of, I felt like we were having, I know Dan and he's a friend and we had talked a little bit while we were writing our books, but I felt like we were having a discussion without really knowing about it. So now we actually get to have the actual discussion.
Yeah, that sounds great. Amazing.
Yeah.
I wanted to, when I was thinking about your book on the way over here on the subway, I was like, in this era of gluten-free where nobody wants to eat any kind of bread or carbohydrates or anything like that, it was kind of an interesting moment in time for you to be publishing this really sort of seminal work on bread and all of the different varieties. Can you talk a little bit about how that's playing out for you in terms of what people ask or what, is it gluten-free? I mean,
well, it's interesting because I thought I would get a lot of those kind of questions about gluten and, the issues with it, which I go into a little bit in my book. But actually, surprisingly, I haven't. And what I've gotten instead are people coming to my talks who are sort of, I get this sense from them that oh, thank God, I can finally like bread again. You know, you know, it's like
it's
I can.
Cool
it's like I can come out of the closet.
Yeah. I can imagine. Well, I mean, I love bread myself, and I do limit myself mostly because bread, just in general, is not that great unless you find a good bakery.
Right.
I happen to have a great bakery locally, but I don't always go to it. But I mean, in general, bread is not my thing. But I grew up making bread. My mom made bread every single week because we just had no growing up in the country. We had no access to good bakeries, and so it was something that we played with a lot and did a lot of different kinds of bread. Although she was very hooked on French bread. But
And actually the book is kind of similar in sort of the questions we explore at Fern, which is really understanding the food, you know, our foods and where they mm-hmm. came from and what has happened with them. You know, and you mentioned Lisa Hamilton, who's going to be talking tonight at Fern Talks and Eats. She did a marvelous story for us, a really groundbreaking story on quinoa for Harper's Magazine.
Right.
And really explored this whole very interesting dynamic of really a battle over the intellectual property rights of the seed itself, which is controlled by Bolivia, where it originates. And, you know, and researchers who are trying to research it to bring it to a wider, you know, so that people consume it more widely than, you know, the quinoa we get at, you know, natural food stores or
right.
Whole Foods or what have you. Because it's kind of, in many ways, kind of a wonder food. But she, you know, really unpacked that, went to Bolivia. And this is what I love about Fern is we have the ability to really support writers, you know, give them the chance to really do the story the right way.
Right.
You know, so she climbed the 12,000-foot mountain in Bolivia where quinoa was said to have originated.
Huh.
You know, and she did this with a quinoa farmer there who's very influential, you know, met the most prominent Bolivian quinoa researcher, you know.
Wow.
And then did the same thing with these researchers at Brigham Young University in Utah, and they're mm-hmm. Mormons, and they really look at quinoa as this potential food that could feed a lot of people. And so, you know, I mean, it sort of unwound and explored quinoa on so many different levels.
Now, isn't it true that because of the rise in interest in quinoa around the world, and especially in the United States, that quinoa is now being exported to a greater degree than ever before, and now leaving the indigenous population of Bolivia, Peru, I always thought it was a Peruvian grain, but anyway, short on quinoa, which had been a sustaining grain for that.
Yeah, it's
especially
not only
the Andean populations.
Yeah, and it's not only a sustaining grain, but it really has kind of, you know, spiritual religious significance to the farmers of
uh-huh.
the grain. And so yeah, that's an issue, but it's also brought, you know, economic benefits
right.
to them.
Right.
Yeah, and so she really got into all of that in this story, which we've now posted on our website at thefern.org, and so you could read to your heart's content
yeah.
about quinoa. So,
yeah.
But that's kind of like, you know, all of the stories we do, all of the writers we work with are kind of doing that kind of project. And
right.
I think you'll see sort of the stand-up version, you know, tonight at Fern Talks.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It kind of sounds like a really amazing event. So what else does Fern, I mean, how did you guys get started? Let's unpack Fern for a minute here, because you came on this show when it first started, which is like 4 years ago, right? We did a
right.
phone interview, and I was like all gaga about it. I still am. And and it was just like you were literally nascent. I mean, it was just the beginning of the whole thing. Was this your idea? Like, how did Fern come to be? Because you have a very interesting board. You have like very interesting people working with you.
Yeah, it really it wasn't my idea. It was kind of an idea of a group of people, a group of writers. And, you know, we felt that there were these really talented people out there who didn't have outlets for their work, mostly because media was imploding and places had stopped, you know, paying for writing and everything
yeah.
else. And no one, you know, the type of in-depth journalism that we do wasn't being supported. So we thought, one, you know, food and agriculture and environmental health, which are our areas of coverage, are really important issues. People are obviously really interested in it. I mean,
yes.
we have this radio show overlooking a restaurant. I mean, how you know, how more connected can you be? We felt that if we could somehow bring the financial means to support writers You know, we could develop stories and then partner with media companies to produce them, and we would bring some, you know, a financial piece to the table, so it would be less onerous in terms of cost for them,
right?
For the media companies.
That's what I think is the most interesting aspect of your organization, is that it's not just like an online newspaper, or, you know, not to diss Grist or Civilese or any of the other publications, which I so admire, Mother Jones, whatever, but that you actually engage with mainstream media and manage to sell these stories into mainstream media, which I think in a lot of ways, you know, I guess because you bring the financial piece of the puzzle there, but you explore topics that I think a lot of commercial media would shy away from in general, because it's perhaps they have an advertiser who wouldn't really appreciate knowing that, you know, pigs are being housed in giant warehouses with rivers of shit underneath them. I mean, you know, like there's like a fine line there, I think. And I'm wondering how you kind of tread that ground. There's no conflict of interest between advertisers and mainstream media that has limited your access to.
Yeah, we haven't found that. And actually, surprisingly, I thought what we were bringing was kind of a financial piece to the table, because we're supported by individuals, some of whom are, you know, everybody coming tonight is actually making a donation to Fern, foundations and what have you. But the financial piece is actually just one part of the puzzle, and I didn't realize this until about a year into the project. And what we're really bringing is access to great writers, access to great ideas, and we have an editorial team that really develops these stories. So in a sense, the publication can partially, you know, outsource this piece to us.
Yeah.
And they're kind of overseeing it, so it works for their publication, but we really bring a lot to the table to make it work for them.
Right.
And
right.
So, you know, in this time of tight budgets and everything else, that, you know, and editors who are extremely time stretched, you know, it makes sense. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And we have a really great, you know, professional team with many, many years of experience. So we, you know, it's like, you know, in this area of food and environment and ag writing, we're kind of like, you know, we have an A team that can really, really bring great stories.
Well, you're kind of unique in that way, I think, actually.
Yeah, I mean, because we have this focus, and writers who are interested in this area can, you know to come to us, because we'll develop stories of them.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wanted to go on with you for a second about these stories.
Yeah.
Like, how do you decide what you want to develop? I mean, somebody comes to you with a story and says, wow, I just read this piece in the paper about paddlefish and sturgeon roe, and I want to write a piece about, you know, the black market and caviar.
Yeah.
For example. I mean, since
actually,
we did that show.
Right. And that story, Michelle Nyhouse had contacted me.
Yeah.
And she's an amazing, you know, nature and science writer, you know, multiple award-winning writer. And she said, you know, I saw this little press release about these guys getting busted in the Ozarks of Missouri.
It was a great story.
Who were harvesting, you know, paddlefish illegally and selling their eggs as beluga caviar in Europe. I was like, what? What are you talking about?
Yeah, it was a yummy story.
And
no pun intended.
Yeah, and she's actually going to recount that story and some of her reporting around it.
She was
tonight.
A great interview. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
We should go back and look at my archive for Michelle Nyhouse, because it's Nijuis, I think.
Nijhuis.
Hu-I-S, yeah.
Yeah. And so she did an amazing job. And that story, you know, it took a little while to come to fruition, in part because it was an ongoing federal investigation and trial, which kept getting delayed. And so we kind of waited, but then, you know, the trial wasn't, you know, we finally just decided to go with the story. She had enough. So so that's another one. I mean, she went down to the Ozarks. She met this game warden who was the main guy who was on the trail of these basically, you know, Russian mafia guys in the middle of Missouri who were, you know, poaching paddlefish.
I mean, just
which are sturgeon related. So they're related to sturgeon, which is why they can pass the eggs off.
Yeah.
For people who aren't that savvy.
Right.
So,
it was such an interesting, you know, and what they were doing, and the idea that the Russian mafia would have targeted this like tiny town in the Ozarks where there's this, you know, clearly a plentiful supply of paddlefish and not a lot of supervision in terms of fish and game until this one guy gets onto the case.
Right.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, Sam, in terms of Fern, is why is it and this is a much broader question. When I look at like the Times food section or the LA Times food section or Washington Post, and I know like Joe Yonan, I know quite well, and not quite well, but I'm friends with him, and I feel like you guys have hit a nerve. You obviously have a lot of supporters, plenty of people are reading, and yet the food sections of these big or small papers are not picking up on that desire for the public to learn more about food, about how it, not just a recipe, not a technique, but like the real nitty-gritty stories, which you are reporting, which I report here on this radio network, and all, you know, most of my colleagues do. And it's like there is this real hunger for it, and yet somehow, like, I guess advertising doesn't want to pay for it because it's, I mean, again, we run into that sort of conflict between what advertisers are willing to pay for and what kind of content is coming out. And I think that's a difficult question.
Yeah, I mean, advertisers are paying for a particular audience. Mm-hmm. And so, these mass media publications, you know, the ones you mentioned, really have to feed that audience. And a lot of them, frankly, are interested in recipes. I did a bread recipe, you know, for the Washington Post related to my book. And I got like, you know, a lot of email with people asking me questions about the recipe, which is fine. It's like, I totally, you know, there's no problem with that at all. It's just, you know, this is what we do is like one, in that sort of food writing universe, which can include restaurant reviews, recipes, mm-hmm. chef profiles, you know, this is one, you know, element of that kind of venue.
But sort of an increasingly important element, and something that I feel is really blowing up in terms of at least the West and East Coast public, you know, the reading public, people who are interested in food and do want recipes and should get all the recipes that they want. I'm not saying that that isn't an appropriate topic for a food section, but I just find it fascinating that somebody, you know, some of the Fern writers or like somebody like Tom Philpott, who's a regular guest here and writes a lot about agricultural issues. And, you know, it's just like, well, why isn't that going into the Times? Why,
right.
You know, why aren't they picking up on this stuff? And I find it very curious that there is almost a complete dearth of reporting on big issues.
Well, the Times, you got to give credit to like Michael Moss, who did, you know, incredible for them.
But that's and 2-3 times a year, maybe?
Yeah, well,
I mean, his stories take a lot of time.
Yeah, it take a lot of time to do because they're really groundbreaking.
Yeah.
You know, could there be more? Probably, you know, but it's again, it's that, I mean, I kind of get it because, you know, it's like if you do more one thing, you got to do less of something else. So what are you going to do, you know, less of, you know, and that said, that's why we reach out to so many different venues from, you know, science magazines to food magazines to sort of those with a health/food bent,
right,
to even, online places like Medium, which we did this fantastic story with Maren McKenna, who's also talking tonight, on the end of antibiotics. And she kind of looked into the future about what happens when we lose antibiotics.
Right.
Pretty scary stuff that she kind of mapped out.
Terrified.
It wasn't just her. I mean, she was getting these experts from CDC and everybody else to talk about this.
Oh, yeah.
And that story, like, went viral. I mean, it got 500,000 people have read that story. It's been translated into 3 languages.
Yeah.
Appeared in mainstream media as well as online.
It did, yeah.
So, there definitely is an audience for this stuff. It's just a question of placing it in the right place so that it gets that initial hit and then finds that audience.
And tell me about some of your media partners. You mentioned Harper's, you mentioned Medium. Where else have you placed stories? The Atlantic, probably.
Yeah, The Atlantic. We've done a piece with The Washington Post. We've done some broadcast stories with ABC News. We've done NBCNews.com. On and on. We've got more than, you know, we've got nearly 25 places that we've placed stories.
And how do you approach them with a story idea, especially if it's sort of off their beaten track? Like, I don't think of ABC News as somebody who regularly, you know, covers food and environmental issues.
Yeah. Well, it's just got to work for their venue with mm-hmm. television. It's got to have great
visuals. Right.
Yeah. And so we did a story on toxic algae blooms and had a picture of kids covered in this green muck.
Nice.
And,
was that from the Lake Erie from the summer?
It was related. It wasn't this year. It was 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so it came back this year.
Yeah.
And it was also tied to dogs that died and because they drank the toxic water of these lakes. And the lakes became toxic with this algae because they were being fed from fertilizer runoff from farms.
So. Yeah, I've had Tom Philpott on here to talk about that. I've had Paul Greenberg talking about
the
dead zone in the Gulf. I mean, yeah, totally schooled on the agricultural implications.
So that was, not an abstract thing. That was, there were pretty strong visuals with that.
Very strong visuals.
For that story. So that's the kind of thing that, we try and take the right story to the right venue.
Yeah. Well, let's take a quick sponsor drop and we'll be right back with Sam Frohmartz from the Food and Environmental Reporting Network. We're talking about the event tonight at the Green Building in Carroll Gardens. Check it out and see if there's still tickets.
And you're listening to Lung by Iggy Dean on heritageradionetwork.org.
Since 2001, Heritage Foods USA has sold pasture-raised, antibiotic-free heritage meats to restaurants and homes around the country. Our farmers raise their animals with care using traditional methods guaranteed to produce the very best-tasting meat. Our pork breeds include Berkshire, Red Wattle, Duroc, Gloucester Old Spot, Large Black, and Tamworth, and our beef comes from Piedmontese, Angus Akiyushi, Belgian Blue, Highland, Simmental, and Belted Galloway cattle. We also carry a rotation of 24 rare breeds of heritage chicken, seasonal specialties like lamb, goat, geese, and of course, heritage turkeys. Visit us online at www.heritagefoodsusa.com or give us a call at 718-389-0985 to place your order today.
You're listening to What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and we're talking today with Sam Frohmartz, who's the editor-in-chief for FERN, otherwise known as the Food and Environmental Reporting Network, one of my very favorite media sources for information about our food and our environment. So, Sam, you guys got a whopping big grant to do this event tonight, which, by the way, let's talk about funding, but also let's expand a little bit more because you have, like, performers, and aside from having people talking and all this great food, there's going to be like what? I mean, multimedia, very hip and contempo, really cool stuff.
Yeah. Well, the initial idea was to, all our stories about food are about food. So it was kind of natural to pair them with chefs.
Sure.
And the initial idea was let the chefs interpret the talk in a dish. And so that's going forward. So with each talk, and there's like four talks plus Dan Barber and my conversation, there are going to be specific dishes that are paired with the talk.
Oh, wow.
So that came off. And then we brought
in... Does that mean we're going to have caviar?
We're going to have paddlefish.
Cool.
Everyone gets one egg. I mean, we're a nonprofit, right?
Did you make bread?
I didn't make bread, but we're getting bread from Runner and Stone, which is a really marvelous bakery.
Yeah.
Very close to the venue, actually. And
fantastic.
Peter Andrus there is a really marvelous baker, and it's a great restaurant.
Yeah.
So they're doing breads for us as well as some.
Wonderful.
We're going to have some grain dishes.
Yeah.
you know, Dan Barber talks about, you know, eating the whole farm in terms of, you know, all the grains that are grown on a farm and not just like the choice vegetables. So we're going to have a dish that reflects that, which is, you know, pretty
That sounds interesting. Yeah, absolutely.
And, but then we're going to have actors who are working with the writers in some cases. There's going to be some music.
Amazing. And we is actually produced by a, like, producer
By a theater director.
Theater director.
So, it's really ambitious, but I think it'll be really entertaining.
How many people can the space accommodate?
I think it's close to 300. I think we have food for 250 people, and I'm told we have 5 tickets left.
Whoa!
At this moment for food.
Yeah. So where do people go to get that ticket if they want to call
Fern
in right
Talks
now?
ferntalksandeats.com.
Yeah, go there now, ferntalksandeats.com.
5 tickets left.
Get on into the, be hip, be groovy.
So
Jack's on the phone right now.
So we came up with this idea, and we belong to an organization that pools all of these nonprofit news organizations called INN, Investigative News Network.
Right. Yes.
And they partnered with the Knight Foundation on what were called innovation grants.
Right.
And they wanted proposals from nonprofit news organizations to come up with potentially revenue-generating sources, and that they would help back a few organizations in this initial grant round to try and come up with something basically to make money, because we're all nonprofits, but we can't just depend on foundation funding.
Sure. So you've got to provide some kind of entertainment.
Right. So that's why we're, you know, selling tickets and everything else. And our mandate is to explore whether this could be a revenue generating model for us, because we have a bunch of sponsors as well.
Feel free to mention some of those sponsors.
Yeah.
I'm all about stroking the sponsors.
We got a lot, so I'd have to look them up. I think something like, you know, more than 100 organizations applied, and just a handful were given the grants. So
I think it was like 8.
Yeah,
I was reading the little press release.
Right.
Yeah.
So we actually got, you know, we got the grant.
So the grant is actually basically to help you, not to be part of your carrying costs, but to help you produce events to generate revenue. That's the point of these INN grants. Is that right?
Correct. Correct. Yeah. As a way to supplement, you know, your foundation funding as well as individual donations.
How did you guys get the seed money for an event, for an organization like this? That must have been, you know,
some initial planning grants, and then, you know, we just went out and beat the pavement. And I got to say, I'm like the words guy. I'm the editorial guy. And, and luckily, I'm very bad at asking people for money.
Yeah, so, me too. I hate it.
So, but luckily, we have an executive director, Tom Laskaway, and also Paula Crossfield, who's one of the founders, who was a managing editor. And they were really the two who got the organization going and got the initial grants. And they are really good at asking for money.
Yeah, so, it's a talent, man. Yeah. That's why development people get paid the big bucks.
Yeah,
it's really not an easy job. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, and just our sponsors, like WNYC Radio, is giving us promotion, which is great. Annie's, you know, we all know them.
Yeah.
You know, the edible
public communities,
Organic Valley, the organic dairy company.
Yeah.
New York Distilling Company, Sovereign Cider, Fleischer's Pasture Raised Meats, Cleaver Company, and
Mary Cleaver is going to be there tonight, right?
I think so.
Yeah, I love her.
Stonyfield, The Clean Plate, and Happy Cooking.
Yeah,
so wonderful. Yeah, we got a few that'll help.
Is she producing food for you, or just part of the sort of general support system?
That's a good question.
Yeah, not sure.
Not sure.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah.
Anyway, Mary was one of my first employers when I got into the food business as a very young person. So we go back a long, long way. I used to work in her kitchen when it was illegal. She probably hate me for saying that. But yeah, I mean, she started out working in her loft on Franklin Street, you know?
Right.
So, yeah.
And actually, I think she is the one doing the food, working with the chefs.
She's just a terrific person and just been so forward-thinking for so long. I mean, she was really a voice in the wilderness for so many years, and then everybody else started getting on the bandwagon with her. It's like, she's the bomb.
Yeah. It's interesting. There's so many moving parts in this event with the director, the actors, the writers, the chefs from the restaurants, you know, the caterer. And so, you know, I've been sort of, it feels like the Three Ring Circus. And I've been watching a little bit from afar and helping the writers develop their talks.
Yeah.
But it's really, everybody has like been amazing.
That's exciting.
I mean, we got a really great team. So hopefully that'll be reflected in the event tonight.
And hopefully everybody will have a blast and they'll want more and more and more.
Yeah.
And you'll just have to keep on adding writers to your stable so that you have more stuff to write about.
Right. And we do. We are constantly getting pitches. We're constantly developing stories. You know, we're adding people to our team. We recently got George Black, who's this amazing magazine editor, who was actually the first magazine editor.
I think we did a little piece with him for, just for our new and notable type, you know, our little news feed here.
Right. And he was, when I was a young reporter in my 20s, he edited my first magazine story.
Oh, no kidding.
Completely lost touch with him. And then he was doing environmental writing, editing, and, you know, we circled back because a lot of the writers we worked with George. And so we brought him in. So yeah, it was really amazing.
Where had he been?
He had been at On Earth.
Uh-huh. Sure. So, the NRDC publication.
Right.
Yeah. I do a lot of interviews with their various people, whether it's their attorneys or their reporters or whatever. I do a lot of stuff with NRDC. I love them.
Yeah.
They're great.
So we had been reading, you know, obviously reading them a lot. I know the editors there, and then also, you know, a lot of our writers had been working with them and with George, so it kind of just made sense.
Absolutely. That's wonderful.
To bring them over.
That's really exciting. So now let's talk for a minute about your bread book. Where did that come from? Why did you, like you said, you've been obsessed with bread for 20 years. What happened?
So the short story is Bread is My attempt to keep my sanity as a journalist.
Really?
And I never or hardly wrote about it because it's what I did to relax.
Uh-huh.
And before I started bread making, I would consider like chopping garlic the way that I relax at the end of the day.
Kind of like ironing.
Yeah.
I find that very relaxing. Yeah. Cooking in general, I find intensely relaxing.
Right. And so I had moved to D.C. from New York, couldn't find any good bread near my house that I liked.
Right.
So I thought, I'll just start making it myself.
Right.
And this was the late 90s.
Yeah.
You know, at that time, there wasn't the scene there is now. Obviously, there was, you know, a couple of books.
Yeah.
Dan Leder at Bread Alone was
Beard on Bread. That's what I grew up with.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't use Beard on Bread because I was like, it was immediately sort of taken by the more sourdough, approaches. Nancy Silverton at La Brea Bakery in LA. She did a great book. And so I just started. I started making bread, and you know, it was funny because writers always, you know, it's like everything is material, right?
Yeah.
But I just, you know, it was such a special time of my day, and I just didn't want to confuse it with work and deadlines and everything because I thought I would ruin it. So I purposely like kind of avoided it until the recession hit in 2008. This is pre-Fern. I was out of work and lost a couple of key clients that I had done editing for. And a friend of mine said, you know, do you have any story ideas? And she was editing a travel magazine. And I said, I've always wanted to go to Paris to learn how to perfect a baguette because it's eluded me at home for like more than a decade.
Absolutely.
So that became
very hard.
That became the first chapter of my
book. So did you perfect it?
Well, I got a lot better at it, and I came back, and actually a food writer, Tim Carman, who's now with the Washington Post.
Oh, yeah, I know Tim.
Yeah, he put my breads up against all professional bakers in Washington, and my baguettes won in a blind tasting. So,
wow, cool, Sam. So what's the secret, if you don't mind my asking?
The biggest secret that I explain in the book is basically time, that bread is slow food.
It
can't be rushed.
Yeah.
And any time you try and rush it, you're going to be able to make bread, but it's not going to be very good. So all the, you know, flavor, everything else really takes time to develop. The great thing about that is it's not time that you're working. The dough is doing the work.
Yeah.
So, and you know, it's like any fermented food. You know, pickles take time to develop, you know, kimchi, everything else. And bread is the same. Bread is a fermented food. So it takes time for fermentation to work to really bring out the flavors of that bread. So I would say that's the most important thing that, and I think recipes are kind of getting, you know, a lot of books are now emphasizing that, which is great. And I kind of explain why, you know, all the facets of why that's important.
So if you let your bread rise long enough, then you're going to get a better tasting loaf. What about making the crust crispy and stuff
it'll
like
make
that?
It'll basically what it does in that fermentation is it converts carbohydrates to sugars. So the loaf will taste sweeter. Those sugars will kind of caramelize and, mm-hmm. and brown, you know, when it's baking. The interior texture of the loaf will be better,
lighter and fluffier.
Less dense, in all number of ways.
So why is it that, I mean, I've made French bread a million times, and it's okay, but it's certainly not a baguette.
You got to read my book.
I got to read your book, Sam. Did you bring me a copy?
You should have.
I should have told Naomi. No kidding.
Yeah.
So what ended up being your favorite bread recipe from your book?
I have no favorite. I have, like, standards that I make.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I make kind of a house loaf that has rye, whole wheat, some white, and lately I've been adding buckwheat to that mm-hmm. to that mix, and it's really, cook it really dark. It's really a great sourdough loaf.
Mm. So you advocate a sourdough starter as opposed to a yeast?
No, actually, I think yeast is fine. The problem with yeast is people tend to use too much, and it speeds everything up, and then you have all the problems that I talk about.
Ah.
So use very little yeast. And Jim Leahy's no-knead bread recipe sort of championed that approach with just a quarter teaspoon of yeast.
Right, and then you rise over the night in his recipe,
right.
I believe.
And I rise anywhere from, you know, 12 to 48 hours, and I usually
Do you rise in the refrigerator?
I rise it in the refrigerator,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
And do you squirt water into the oven while it's baking to enhance the crust?
No, and you do need to create steam in some way to uh-huh. really create a crispy crust. You know, in the Leahy no-knead method, they bake the bread in
like a
pot.
Cloche.
And then you take off the top after about half an hour. So it's sort of steaming inside the pot.
Uh-huh.
What I do is I sometimes use the pot method, but more often I just have a rimmed sheet pan on the bottom of the oven.
Yeah.
And when I put the bread in, I pour basically 2/3 of a cup of boiling water into that sheet pan.
Uh-huh.
Steams
and that creates
up,
a steam.
Shut the oven door, and just don't open the door.
I am so inspired. I mean, literally, I'm going to go home and make bread.
Yeah.
The other thing I've been thinking about making a lot is yogurt. So, you know, there you go, because that's on my way to becoming a cheesemaker. So, yeah.
Right. And yogurt, I think, is pretty easy.
Pretty, very easy.
So,
yeah.
But the best thing about, the thing I really loved about my book is I met all of these really obsessed, eccentric bakers in California, in the south of France, a guy who was growing his own ancient wheat, milling it himself in a windmill and baking it for his village.
Wicked cool.
And then, you know, went to Berlin and worked in a bakery where they were grinding their own biodynamically grown grains.
Yeah.
You know, making these really fabulous whole grain loaves.
Yeah.
And I wanted to go there because whole grains are just consumed as bread. It's not like we're not eating whole grains because people tell us to or because it's healthy.
Yeah.
You know, eat it because it's good. Because
it tastes good.
And I just wanted to go to a place where that was, you know, where that was the bread.
Right.
And I learned a lot from them.
That sounds great. Well, the name of the book is In Search of the Perfect Loaf, right?
In Search of the Perfect Loaf, A Home Baker's Odyssey.
Yeah. So people should rush right out and pick up a copy of this and get busy with the yeast and the sourdough starter because it sounds really, really great. You've gotten wonderful reviews for the book. I mean, outstanding. So
thank you. Yeah.
And the fact that you beat regular bakers out in a baguette contest X number of years ago, that's very inspiring, Sam. And tonight's event, hopefully no more tickets left, but just in case you want to do that, go to ferntalksandeats.com and pick up those last few seats for what promises to be a really extraordinary extraordinary event, like really unusual, that totally caught my eye. I was just like, wow, you guys, that's crazy. It sounds wonderful. So thanks so much for joining us. And you have, well, it's obviously fern.org if people want to learn more about
thefern.org.
And you can sign up for the newsletter. You can get those articles delivered into your email box on a regular basis. I urge people to sign up for this publication. I have learned so much about so many disparate things that I never would have done any research on myself had they not been brought to my attention through Fern. So,
and we'll have more. We'll have more coming your way soon.
Yeah, so. I'm looking forward to hearing what you're doing next. Yeah. So, thanks so much for joining me today, Sam. I really appreciate you coming out to the studio. Jim,
thank you.
Fun.
It's great to be here.
It was great to have somebody across this table from me instead of just kind of like watching people eat their pizza at rest. And thanks to Heritage Foods USA for the support today for my program. And we'll see you next week. Thanks a lot for listening, and have a great week, folks. So long now.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.